And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is on, and Max Verstappen gave the Orange Army that created an extraordinary atmosphere at the first Dutch Grand Prix in 36 years with a home victory. But it was a close one, with Lewis Hamilton pressuring him throughout. But could he have done more to push for victory? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to answer this question and many more are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Well, Mark, like me, you were at Zandvoort. Phenomenal to be back here. Great atmosphere the Dutch fans created.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. First time I've been here since 91, I think. And it's some of it very familiar looking, and the general feel of the place, just as I remember it, but obviously the circuit a little bit different. But it's never seen an event like this, even in its heyday. It's first heyday. This was just a phenomenal sporting event.
Yeah, the perfect time for the Dutch Grand Prix is, of course, all about Max Verstappen. Scott Mitchell, you were watching from afar. Did that atmosphere and the excitement of the crowd and the noise come across through the television coverage?
Yeah, because there were still things throughout the weekend where the roar of the crowd was unmistakable. One of the loudest was for when Hamilton stopped on track at the start of FP2. That was incredibly audible in the TV coverage, but just everything, just the amazing jubilant scenes in the grandstands, the bright orange colours that just dominated every scenic shot of the track, the smoke from the flares coming across, and everything about it. Just, I obviously can only imagine what it would have been like actually being there, but it was one of those events where it just does an amazing job of coming through the television coverage that this is a real event. And while obviously I think it is a bit more powerful because we've just had so long without fans and we're still getting used to it again, but it's kind of a bit like how the post-race scenes at Silverstone were just so evocative. This was that and a bit more, I think, because this was, a smaller crowd, but you wouldn't have guessed it. It was a cauldron of energy and passion and support. And yeah, that absolutely came across in the television coverage.
It's absolutely brilliant. When you have a well-attended home race for a big-name driver, it's absolutely brilliant and in many ways great that they got their home success. I have to say that cheer you mentioned when Hamilton stopped in FP2, I was watching it turn three at the banking and I heard the big cheer and I hadn't seen what happened. I didn't know why there was a red flag. And I thought, oh, blimey, someone's probably had a big one because it sounded to me like the cheer when a driver gets out of the car after a big accident. But it was all good kind of knockabout stuff and good-natured as well. So I think it worked really well. Now, we do, of course, have questions from the Race Members Club on this podcast. And just before we get into the race, Scott, We had one question from Oscar Robledo, who asked if the track will work with the banking for the new regs. Any reason why not?
I can't see any reason why it shouldn't. The only thing I would imagine that changes for next year on the banking is obviously the new regs kind of throw F1's reference point for whether or not the DRS could be used through the banked final corner. That is something that I believe they were going to use the data from this event to then reconsider for next year. But obviously the downforce levels and the grip that the cars are producing are going to be very different in 2022. So I'm not really sure what a 2021 car could do with DRS open through the banked final corner is entirely relevant to what a 2022 car could do. But in terms of everything else, there's nothing I can think of within the way the cars are going to be designed that would stop them being able to take the banked turns three and the final corner as well. And it would be, I would advocate F1 suddenly at the last second tearing up its aero rulebook for 2022 and redoing the cars to allow them to go on the banking if there was any kind of problem, because the addition of turn three, especially, I think is one of the great additions to the F1 calendar for as long as I can remember. And I'd honestly rather us have to come up with a last minute completely new rule book than have to get rid of a corner like that.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. Watching it during that FP2 session was absolutely fantastic. It is right up there with the great corners now, just because there was so much variety in terms of the way they approached it. But let's get on to the race, Mark. While Max Verstappen and Red Bull were always in control, Hamilton and Mercedes did pose a few strategic questions along the way. So my usual question is, how was the race won? But I guess it has to start with qualifying, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, there were, as an overall reference point, the Red Bull Honda was just a few tenths quicker than the Mercedes this weekend. And the Mercedes had a particular problem through turn two and three, and that's sort of all one sequence, really. And it just didn't work there the whole weekend, and it was losing almost two tenths, even by the time that fashioned it as well as they could in terms of setup. It was still losing two tenths just through that sequence alone. And so that really defined the competitive shape between the two cars. And after that, really, it was just a question of Max and Red Bull sort of maximizing that package that they had under them. And it almost went wrong in qualifying. He didn't quite lose pole, but he only clinched it by a few hundredths with a non-operative DRS that cost, that was later calculated, 0.183. And a bit of a moment coming out of turn three on his final lap that cost him, they reckon, just around two tenths. So he's potentially on pole by well over three tenths, and just a power rescued it by a few hundredths. But that was okay. It's only being on pole that counts. So that was the foundation. The pole was the foundation. But then is just astronomical first lap. It was just one of the all-time great first laps. He was just gone, and I think he crossed the line 1.7 seconds ahead at the end of the first lap. And that was absolutely crucial because it was the slowest car at the end of the straight. So he needed to be a long way clear of Hamilton, and he knew that. He needed to be a long way clear of Hamilton on that first lap because potentially the Mercedes was going to devour it and get ahead going into the Red Bull's best bit. And then, you know, he's then got a much more difficult job on his hands if he's been passed by the Mercedes. So, he managed to do that with an absolutely epic first lap. And then it was really just the usual sort of cat and mouse game of strategy, and they decided earlier on that it was going to be a two-stop. That was, if you were running up the front and you could get a good gap behind you so you didn't have to worry too much about how much traffic you were going to have to fight through, a two-stop was a faster way of doing it, and they both committed to that pretty early on. Red Bull would have known that even if they'd tried to do a one-stop, Mercedes would have counted with a two-stop and forced them into it anyway, so they just took control of it that way early on. There's a couple of little gaps where Lewis got close enough that he might have been able to undercut ahead and get track position. One was where they left Valtteri Bottas out a long time after Max and Lewis had stopped, enough to delay Max, and it got Lewis right onto Max's tail. And had he come in at that point, yes, he would have undercut ahead, but it would have been a very, very long subsequent stint. It was very poor spacing of the stint length, and he would have been at a big tire disadvantage later on. And you just have to assume that he probably wouldn't have been able to hang on against a faster car on much faster tires at the end, which is how that would have panned out, I think. But a couple of little sniffs of opportunity. But as Lewis said afterwards, he said it would have had, even to have just the slightest chance, everything would have had to been perfect. The pit stops, the traffic parting in the right way, the strategy calls, everything. And he said that none of those things were absolutely perfect on the day. But the underlying thing was that Max and Red Bull were just a good few tenths quicker. They were just playing, really. They had enough in hand that they could edge it out and do it as needed. They could just pull out the gap when needed, and they had an answer. They had the raw performance to have an answer for everything that Mercedes and Hamilton could throw at them.
We have inevitably had a few questions from the Race Members Club about this, which I'll throw at you, Mark. Tamara Salter asks, were Mercedes wrong to bring Lewis in that early for his second pit stop, which brought him back out into traffic? Even Lewis was questioning that decision over the radio. Was it a case of trying to do something different to Max to try and make a difference? And connected to that, Jay Kaufman says, did Mercedes simply think Red Bull wouldn't use the hard? And how did they not consider that volume of traffic? So can you address those? That second stop attracting a lot of interest.
Yeah, the timing of Hamilton's second stops was, in hindsight, a bit early. And I think Mercedes would probably agree with that, looking at it in hindsight. But what actually triggered it was that Hamilton, having been sort of keeping the gap at 1.6, 1.7 seconds and looking to Mercedes as if he was matching, able to match the Red Bull's pace at this phase of the race, suddenly Max, having been told to just give it everything he'd got, just sliced a huge amount off his lap times, like something like 7/10 on two consecutive laps. And suddenly that 1.7 second gap had ballooned into almost 3 seconds in just a couple of laps. And Mercedes, before that got too big, brought him in at that point. So it was basically the underlying pace that Red Bull had been hiding that when they unleashed it, suddenly triggered Mercedes into bringing Hamilton in before too much damage was done. And I think really the whatever the choice of tyre Red Bull would make wouldn't really have had that much effect on the track position at that time. The outlap would have been a bit slow with the hard tyre on with the Red Bull, but not by... It wouldn't really have mattered. It wouldn't have changed anything meaningful.
We should also talk about the other Mercedes of Valtteri Bottas. Scott, there was a little mini drama at the end with Bottas coming in at the end of lap 67 for what Mercedes said was a precautionary pit stop. And then, of course, the plan was Hamilton would then come in to set fastest lap. He then did 95% of a proper fastest lap. Hamilton, of course, did reclaim that fastest lap after his point. But Tamara Salter asks, what are your thoughts on this situation? And points out that if anyone was in any doubt that Bottas won't be at Mercedes next year, then the fact he did temporarily have fastest lap is surely proof. So what did you make of that whole episode?
Well, I thought it was indicative of a driver who's a bit frustrated at having to play second fiddle. And even though Bottas will know that that was the right thing for Mercedes to do, protect that point for Hamilton, It was just something that even in the moment he's just too annoyed to initially accept it, basically. And you know, he says that by the time he was told to abandon the lap at the end, in sector three, he was just sort of playing games, which I think was a reference to sort of how he approached sector three, rather than suggesting he was playing games with Mercedes. And he sort of said, "Well, you know, I knew I'd backed off enough that if Lewis had just done like a normal lap and then done sector three properly, he would have easily beaten my lap time." But it's not really the point. He still created a situation where Lewis had to set the fastest lap on the final lap to get that point back, which is just unnecessary, because there could have been anything. There could have been a bit of traffic. Hamilton could have had a problem. There could have been a yellow flag. there are all sorts of things there that could have stopped Hamilton from actually completing the lap the way he needed to in order to set the fastest lap. He could have made a mistake. He could have done something, you know, because he's having to push harder than he needs to do. And it's just something that, you know, Hamilton has the performance there and the ability there to set that fastest lap if someone else goes faster and he needs to do it on the very last lap of the Grand Prix. To need to do it because your teammate has unnecessarily set a faster lap time, it's just unnecessary. I kind of understand why Bottas did it. I'm not saying that anyone competitive wouldn't feel frustrated or anything like that, but it does feel a bit unprofessional. It does feel a bit unnecessary. And also, just in a more extreme sense, it doesn't send the strongest team player message, does it? I know that Valtteri's future is probably already secure for 2022, and one incident like this isn't going to fundamentally change anyone's opinion of him, but I just don't think it sends a great image of yourself if it's kind of like, well, you know, I've had enough and I'm throwing my toys out the pram, so I'm just going to be a bit difficult. But I just think it's a bit unnecessary, especially because Bottas just isn't that kind of person or driver. So these are just sort of his moments where it's almost feels like he's acting out a little bit. But this is as much as he can act out, because he's just not got it in him to do anything worse than this.
Yeah, he's still too much of a team player even when he does that. But it was funny because Toto Wolff after the race said, yeah, it was all fine because he did back off. But I did then say to Toto, well, obviously it did create a situation, because as you said, Scott, if there was a yellow flag even, it could have cost Hamilton a point. This championship could easily be won or lost by a point. So he did admit they'd have a little amicable chat about it afterwards. So it's not sort of a big controversy or anything, but just a little interesting subplot. But on the subject of Bottas, Mark, ultimately, he could have been a factor at the front, but he wasn't really, was he? He ended up being a bit of a distant third. And that's, I guess, the problem for Bottas, isn't he? He's just not, in race conditions, always quite quick enough to play the role that Mercedes really needed, because he could have changed that race.
Yes, although I don't think we're quite comparing like with like there on in terms of pure pace, because the intention at Mercedes was always to split the strategy with put Valtteri on a one-stop and Lewis on a two, so that they could sort of try and put a pincer movement on Verstappen. But so, yeah, Valtteri was having to drive to a pace so that he knew he was doing a much longer initial stint, and that's where he fell behind. But yeah, I don't think if you'd swapped roles, you'd said Lewis is going to be on a one stop and Valtteri on a two, I don't think you would have seen it play out the way it did. I think you would have still seen Lewis come out on top. So yeah, so he's very shown over the years. He's very very quick over one lap, sometimes quicker than Lewis, although only a couple of times this year. But yeah, the biggest deficit remains in the race, and just that combination of managing the tyres and the pace at the same time. It's just not on the same level as Lewis, but hardly anybody else is either.
It's the way that Mercedes sort of pincer strategy came undone so, I don't want to say easily, but so quickly when Verstappen caught back up to Bottas. And I know there was such a big tyre offset, you can't really expect Bottas to hold on too long, but it was a little bit like France. I thought it was actually a little bit worse, where I thought it was worse this time than it was in France, where you're like, okay, well, Valtteri, all you need, he even got the message, didn't he? Like, you're defending the race lead here. This is basically crucial for the race. And like the first time Max gets within sniffing distance of Valtteri, there's just a tiny error. It wasn't huge. It's not like he went through the gravel or anything like that, but it was just enough of an error to put Max immediately on his tail, and just the move was done basically before they were even activating. Max was even activating DRS. He got such a great run on him through the final corner, and it's just, again, taking it as if the roles were reversed, I just don't think Lewis makes it quite as easy for Max to get in front. And I don't know whether I don't think it transforms the race entirely, but I do think that pincer movement was the best chance Mercedes had of unsettling Max properly. And Hamilton barely had enough chance to get onto the back of Verstappen before Verstappen was already ahead of the other Mercedes. So yeah, I thought like the fastest lap thing was a bit a bit rubbish, but whatever. I actually thought like the worst thing Bottas did in terms of the job he was meant to do for Mercedes today came earlier in the race with that. I just feel like he could or should have held on a bit longer than he did.
Yeah, and it's just the normal thing with Bottas. He's a very, very good driver, but particularly with Verstappen and Hamilton pushing each other so hard in this race, everyone up to and including fourth was lapped, so the pace was red hot ultimately. So that's always going to make life a little bit difficult for him. Mark, let's just quickly look at the wider significance. Verstappen's got a 3-point championship lead. Mercedes is still ahead in the Constructors' Championship by 12 points, which is in large part thanks to Bottas making a much bigger contribution than Perez this weekend. Simon T asks, what can we take from this race with regards to the relative strengths and weaknesses of the Red Bull and Mercedes, and how might this play out over the rest of the season? Any conclusions from this one?
I think it's confirmation of the pattern that we've seen. If you take Hungary out of the equation, which I've always said was a miss, you know, it wasn't the we didn't see a representative performance from the Red Bull in Hungary. So generally, circuits placing a lot of emphasis on downforce, the Red Bull, you know, is faster. Those circuits that reward efficiency and drag a little bit more, the Mercedes tends to edge it. I think, you know, if you're looking for a pattern between the two cars on circuit types, it's that, really. I don't think the other things that have been put forward, such as engine developments one way or the other on the Mercedes or the Honda side, or the Mercedes up, you know, changing the barge boards and the floor at Silverstone, or the new tougher rear tire, I think these are just things that are going on around that. I think the basic thing driving the performance from circuit to circuit is just the low and high rec aero philosophies, and what one works spectacularly well on a circuit like this, we need lots of downforce, and the other one works better at places like Monza and Spa.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see that played out on the remaining tracks for the rest of the season. Well, Scott, looking outside the top three, Pierre Gasly described his fourth on the grid on Saturday as our pole position. So it follows that his fourth in the race was AlphaTauri's win in the race. Verstappen and Mercedes were a class apart. Gasly was a lap down, such was the pace. Do you have any sympathy for Gasly saying he's puzzled not to get a Red Bull return as he did on Saturday, given this was such a, again, a strong performance from him, which we're seeing quite consistently?
Well, not really, because I didn't see anything in this Grand Prix or this weekend that we haven't seen from Gasly at other times this year or last year. I think this is Gasly at his peak. I think it's Gasly that only this team can sort of bring out of him, and he brings the best out of the team. We know that the Red Bull, especially the last 2 or 3 years, has had a trait of rear instability that Max is incredibly good at handling and other drivers aren't. And Gasly, I think, is one of them. I think Gasly can get to the maximum, or very, very, very close to the maximum, of a car like this year's AlphaTauri and last year's AlphaTauri in a way that I don't think he could even get to this year's Red Bull. We saw at the start of 2019 that there was just something about that the car that he couldn't get his head round, and we know he didn't endear himself to the team with the way that he then applied himself during the struggle to adapt to the Red Bull. So, sympathy, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I don't think there's any more he could do as a driver, and in terms of on-track performances and results, to get a second chance at Red Bull. There was always the suggestion, you know, never say never. He's got the chance to rehabilitate at the sister team. Well, I don't see what else he could have done to have earned another chance. So in that sense, yes, I do have sympathy. The reason that I wouldn't have sympathy is purely because Red Bull know everything they need to know about Gasly. They clearly don't think there's anything different about their car or the way they operate that Gasly would actually go in and do what he's doing now at AlphaTauri, for example. Or there's no reason why he'd go back into Red Bull the second time and do better than he did the first time. So I also think that with that in mind, I don't think that Red Bull is the right place for him to be. I think it's very clear that Pierre thrives in an environment where everyone loves him, where he's not necessarily the center of attention, but he has what he needs and he feels like he has what he needs. I think AlphaTauri's getting the absolute most out of him, and results like this prove that actually he's finishing about where he would in the second Red Bull, if not higher than he would be in the second Red Bull. So in that sense, I don't have sympathy for him, because I think this is a very good place for him to be. I did write a piece, I think just before the Belgian Grand Prix, that he's sort of the driver that the driver market forgot, in the sense, because he's just kind of stuck where he is. Everything keeps moving past him. And in that sense, I do empathise with his situation quite a lot. But ultimately, that return to Red Bull, I think, is a little bit of a red herring in the context of Gasly's career. I just think there are better things for him away from that. So that's why I can't answer the question 100% saying yes, I feel sorry for him.
Yeah, still doing a very good job, but yeah, it's about the type of job he can do and then the style of driver he is. But Mark, let's kind of drop down the order a little bit and go to the recently established Sergio Perez sympathy corner. Obviously, he is the driver who has that Red Bull seat. Well, things went wrong on Saturday. Could you have asked for much more than his recovery to eighth, given the way the race panned out?
Yeah, I could have asked him not to flat spot his set of hards that were supposed to last for ages, but only lasted eight laps. So his race only started after that, after the second setback, the first one being starting from the pit lane as a result of not getting to the flag in time and qualifying, which enabled them to do a few changes, including a new power unit. But the second one was that early pit stop, which ruined the planned strategy. So yeah, he had to start again from scratch there. And I mean, given that he's in a Red Bull, yeah, of course he's going to pass a lot of cars and finish in the points. So I guess some of those passes look very nice. You're going around the outside of Tarzan and you're going wheel to wheel and it look very nice, but in reality, he's passing cars that are up to a second a lap slow, so it is feasible.
Yeah, and he could certainly, without that mistake, have been looking to be sixth place at least. So, yeah, I think there were some problems there. And I do think probably, although he was backed up and everything on his final Q1 lap, he was being warned, and he could have got to the line that little bit quicker to complete that lap, and he didn't need to do something absolutely stellar to get through. So, yeah, I think he's partly the architect of his own problems there, even though he obviously did have a little bit of bad luck as well. But Scott, bouncing back up the order, Charles Leclerc had a pretty straightforward run to a comfortable fifth. A little bit harder for teammate Carlos Sainz, who was passed by Fernando Alonso on the last lap. But unseen on the TV coverage, it was almost a very, very different outcome for Alonso, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I clocked this happen live because I happened to be following Alonso's onboard at the time. And I was amazed to discover that it then didn't make it into the world feed, even on a replay. But that entire Alonso Sainz battle didn't, including Alonso's pass at the very end. So it's fascinating. If anyone does have F1 TV access, I thoroughly recommend going back through it, finding Alonso's going on Alonso's onboard. And I think it's about 1 hour and 36 minutes in exactly. I think you're going to see the moment. I've talked about it in an article that we've published on the race website. Basically, Alonso had got quite close to Sainz into turn one. This was three laps from the end. It was on lap 69, but Alonso had been lapped. He had three more laps to go, including this one. He got close to Sainz through turn one. Didn't quite come off. He followed him through turns two. Obviously, it snakes round. And then obviously turn three, we were talking about at the top of the podcast. So that glorious banking meant that everyone was going in like really high through the corner. And they were all going basically two wheels over the white line onto the runoff on the outside. And the barrier is perilously close there. I mean, you were stood there watching it. There can't be like more than a meter, if that, between basically the edge of the runoff and the barrier. I don't even think there really is. I think maybe it's like 2 or 3 meters from the white line to the barrier. It's sort of tarmac runoff and then just barrier, isn't it? There's nothing there. And basically what Alonso's done going into in the entry to the corner is he's had like a little bit of a moment on the way in, and then he's just locked the brake. He's locked the fronts, and there's just a split second where he's just sliding into the barrier. And when I saw this happen live, I made the weirdest noise. Because it's just one of those moments where like you just think like this guy's having a crash and you're just reacting to someone who's about to have a crash. And then all of a sudden he manages to gather it all back up and unlock the front and steer out of the corner. And actually in this entire moment, he doesn't actually lose that much time. He ends up still in DRS range of Sainz, which means a lap later he's already back on Sainz's case. And then going on to the final lap actually passes Sainz using DRS, and I think he had a bit more ERS deployment off the final corner. So he blasts past him into turn one, which obviously wasn't seen either. But yeah, you've seen the clip I'm talking about, Ed. I don't think I'm overselling it to say that like Alonso very nearly crashed out of the Grand Prix, came really close to crashing out of the Grand Prix two or three laps from the end.
Yeah, no, he was close. Well, you asked him about it, didn't he? And he, I imagine, didn't give you reason to revise that position.
No, actually, it was quite funny because he sort of laughed. I think he thought because it wasn't caught on TV, I think Fernando thought he might have gotten away with it. But he said that he was trying to forget about it, and now I've made him remember that it happened. But then he actually talked through it quite nicely, and he just said... I can't remember the exact phrase he used, but he said basically there was no magic from him keeping it out of the wall. He said it was just complete luck. He was sliding off, both front wheels locked, and then all of a sudden it worked. Do you know what I mean? Like he got it slowed just enough to be able to release everything and then get back onto it. But he said it was just luck. He heart in mouth, he thought he was out of the race, I think.
Yeah, certainly shows how narrow the margins are between success and failure, shall we say. Ended up being a very successful end to the race for him. Sixth place for Fernando Alonso ahead of Carlos Sainz. And then Sergio Perez was eighth because he got Esteban Ocon right near the end of it. But in 10th place, Mark, Lando Norris, it was a difficult weekend for McLaren, wasn't it? They lost third in the constructors' standings to Ferrari. Norris was a little bit subdued in qualifying, only managed a point in the race. So how do you explain probably his most difficult weekend of the year?
Yeah, he said on Saturday he just didn't get it together. I mean, he was denied the final run by the red flag in Q2, the second one where they just abandoned it, basically. And so he maybe would have found a chunk, but he was quite frank. For the first time this year, he just did not put it together, and he felt not tuned into the car, which was unusual because on Friday he'd been super quick in it. And Friday morning on the mediums, he eventually pipped Verstappen on the mediums. And he looked, you know, it looked like it was just going to carry on where it had left off and Spa on Friday. Then on Saturday, it was just all to see. And Daniel Ricciardo was about where Daniel Ricciardo normally is. So I don't know if it was a breakthrough so much for Daniel or just something mysterious not clicking for Lando. I suspect more the latter.
Yeah, and then the race-wise for Norris, he just had to do what he could. There was a little bit of team orders because he ran longer than Daniel Ricciardo, 13 laps longer, I think it was. And then after his stop, he got ordered past. So he kind of salvaged a point, but by Norris standards this year, that doesn't sound a great deal, but it's better than nothing. Although he was ahead of, as I mentioned, Ricciardo, who had an interesting race. He thought his race might be over before it even started. He thought he had a gearbox failure when he pulled into his grid slot because he couldn't get... first engaged, and it went into anti-stall, and he had a quick wave to the starter to warn them that he might be in trouble, and then he'd reported it obviously to the pit wall, and Tom Stallard, his race engineer, just said left-hand start, so meaning because there's a clutch pedal on both sides, use the clutch pedal on the left. And yeah, Ricciardo was quite pleased with his wrong-handed start because he lost a place to Russell, but he actually ended the first lap up a place overall. So good effort from Ricciardo, but didn't really add up to anything because he ended up in 11th place. So, yeah, tricky weekend for McLaren. Well, returning to questions from the race members club, Colin Gallagher asks, what happened to Giovinazzi in the last part of the race? And do you think it'll impact his chances of keeping the seat for next year. I'll take the first part of that. He had a bit of a difficult time on the first lap because he got shoved onto the grass by Sainz. Then he hit the back of Alonso's Alpine. Alonso was having a big moment and actually got a little bit of front end damage. It did cost him a tiny bit of downforce over the race. Held 10th ahead of Russell, stayed there through the pit stops. Although he'd probably have slipped behind Norris and Perez, meaning scoring would have been difficult. He picked up a puncture in that second stint. The team wasn't sure why. Just a sudden deflation. Didn't appear to be caused by contact or anything. And it meant he finished down in 14th behind Sebastian Vettel. That's the story of his race, Scott, and what happened to him. But would you like to address the impact on his chances of keeping the seat?
I'd love to, but I'll be honest. I don't know. There's always so much speculation about where drivers are going in the silly season. I think the Alfa Romeo situation is the most speculative. I've seen three different reports over the last week. One claiming that Giovinazzi is definitely out, one claiming that he's definitely in, and one claiming that he might lose his seat. And in those situations, the two situations where he's supposedly losing his seat, two different drivers are taking it. So I'd rather just be honest and say I don't know. I think, you know, Fred Vasseur, Alpha Team boss, has insisted that there has been no decision taken and the decision will be taken in the coming days. I think that Giovinazzi's qualifying performance sort of was a useful and timely reminder of what he's capable of when everything comes together. But if all it really did was underline every single bit of data that the team will have on him over the last 2.5 years, which is that Giovinazzi at his peak is actually at a very high level. The question is whether he can access that peak regularly enough and actually whether he can convert opportunities that he ends up in into points. And obviously he hasn't done that here. But I think this was a bit more of a... This was Antonio Giovinazzi doing his best George Russell impression in that he did an amazing job on Saturday and then just battled various circumstances, none of which were really in his control, and fell down the order on Sunday. So I don't think this weekend has done anything better or worse, really, for his chances. It was a great reminder of what he's capable of over one lap, but that's about it.
I think what's clear is in this driver market situation with the Williams and Alpha seats, is there's quite a few moving parts there. There were certainly plenty of meetings going on, so that there's still things happening, shall we say, in terms of those decisions. But Mark, Oscar Robledo has a question. He asks, who is the better fit for Williams, Nick De Vries or Alex Albon?
Tricky one. I'd want to know more about Nick De Vries because, we saw him win the F2 championship, but not in a stellar year. We saw him win in Formula E this year, but it doesn't really necessarily translate to the skills that it requires aren't necessarily a perfect dovetailing with those of F1. I'd want to look a bit more deeply into Nick. He's got a good CV, but I'd find it difficult to rate him against a known quantity. Alex, we know plenty about, and I think if you look at the deficit Alex had to Max in his rookie season was about the same as Pierre Gasly had to Max in his second, third season. So I think there's still enough. I think he's shown enough that he'd be worth seriously looking at for Williams. And I'd be erring towards him, but I'd want to know more about Nick.
I think that's a fair point. It does seem that Albon's quite prized now. He seems to have moved into quite a good position. There's all sorts of shenanigans, wasn't there, Scott, with Christian Horner, I think, accusing Mercedes of trying to nobble any chance of Alex Albon going to Williams. Perhaps wasn't quite as simple as that, but it shows it's quite an action-packed driver market at the back, especially with the fact you've got the front-end teams getting involved.
Yeah, it's like the driver market, the silly season, had like a final twist for us. We thought it was heading to quite a sedate conclusion, and now actually it's got a little bit of spice to it. Just Red Bull and Mercedes can find anything to argue over, can't they? This season, this packed with so much needle, they're just looking for excuses to take bites out of each other. I mean, on this occasion, I kind of see both points, but I think Red Bull have less of a case. I don't really think if you're Red Bull and Alex Albon's your driver, I don't think you can bemoan Mercedes stopping Alex from getting a seat in Formula One when Red Bull haven't put him in any of the four Red Bull owned seats. So I don't really think Red Bull have got much of a leg to stand on there. On the Mercedes side, I totally get why you wouldn't want a driver who's embedded within the Red Bull program to have access to your power unit unless you were absolutely certain that driver wasn't going to go back to Red Bull at the end of the year. When Red Bull are building up their own engine program, I know that I'm not saying that a driver is going to run away with all sorts of secrets that are going to make the difference, but there's going to be stuff that you learn that you can then take back to them. And given Red Bull have got Sergio Perez, who has extensive knowledge of how recent Mercedes power units work, they'd then have up-to-date information from Albon potentially at the end of next year. So I understand why you want it. You don't need much of an excuse in that situation to not want that driver there. So I actually think that's kind of a valid position for Mercedes to take. I understand why Red Bull would feel aggrieved by it and just say, well, there's no need for you to stop a driver from having the career opportunity they should have just because you don't like us. But if Red Bull turn around and say, well, you know what, our priority here is Alex. So yes, we're going to cut ties with him. We have no formal contract with him or anything like that. If that's all it takes, call Mercedes bluff. Say, okay, here you go. We'll end his contract the second Williams give him one. You know, it's all just claim and counterclaim with these two, isn't it? It's ping ponging of quotes that just becomes a little bit tedious at times. Let it get resolved. If Mercedes do genuinely have influence in this situation and they're laying down a simple condition for Red Bull to meet, why do Red Bull need to keep Alex under contract for next year? They don't. So let him go. If that's all it needs, they'll get the Williams drive, won't he? Everybody's happy.
Yeah, it's not as if they've got a Formula One race seat they want to put him into. They've got four of them and he's not in any of them. So they can't really complain about that. But I think we will see some of those things moving firmly into place fairly shortly, although we might not be quite wise to hold our breath for that just yet. But I think one move that we are within breath-holding range of is the Russell to Mercedes. But Scott, we saw Russell have a rare off in qualifying. He still managed 11th, despite that, thanks to the red flag caused by Nicholas Latifi. He'd been 12th in the race ahead of Stroll, but for his gearbox problem, he had one stop and then he stopped to retire. So was this a proper hero to zero moment after the highs of Spa?
I don't think it was hero to zero, but I think it was a bump back down to earth. He had a 5 second penalty, didn't he, for speeding in the pits?
Yeah, he said he was just pushing that little bit too hard into the pits because he knew the only chance of kind of getting into points contention was to jump Giovinazzi, who, if memory serves, pitted at the same time. So he admitted his fault, just pushed that little bit too hard.
Yeah, so I just think this was a slightly messy weekend. It wasn't a disaster by any means. Obviously, I think he was a bit lucky to get away with the crash in the way he did in qualifying because it could have been a bit more damaging, but it wasn't hero to zero. It was just it just wasn't heroic, which is obviously what we've come to expect from Russell.
We have, Mark, got used to seeing George Russell do the seemingly impossible in qualifying. He probably stretched that a little bit with his attempt at turn 13, didn't he?
Yes, I was optimistic in the extreme on some used tyres, and he tried to go in there sort of 10 clicks faster than Max Verstappen, and unsurprisingly, the Williams didn't accept it. But yeah, can't fault his confidence.
Yeah, well, he said that they had to go at it at 120%, which is mathematically unsound, but metaphorically acceptable. So he did admit he made a few too many mistakes this weekend. But we should also, Mark, talk about his old teammates, because Kimi Raikkonen, who was not his old teammate, but he became the first driver this season to miss a race because of a positive COVID-19 test. Robert Kubica took over, finished 15th. He was 18th fastest in qualifying. How good was it to see him back racing an F1 car?
Yeah, I got a soft spot for Robert. I think a lot of us have. It was zero notice and on a track that he'd not seen before and had no Friday preparation for, so I was asking a lot for him to do much with that. But he was respectable. He was within 7/10 of Giovinazzi and lapped within 3/10 of him in the race and finished one place behind him. And he did a pass. He succeeded in going around the outside. Latifi, you know, he looked, it was perfectly respectable performance, but I don't think any of us are expecting any of the old Robert magic in such circumstances.
Yeah, it was very much a question of being sensible. He said he took a very safe approach because that was the correct thing. So I followed him throughout Saturday following the onboards, and he did a very, very sensible job, built up nicely. Probably should have been a few tenths faster in qualifying, didn't quite have the tyres up to temperature for that final run in Q1, but it was a very tidy, professional, good performance. And I thought maybe we'd seen him start his last Grand Prix, so that's a bonus. Still a possibility he'll be in the car for Monza as well, so we might get another race out of him. I don't think it changes his position in the driver market. He's not a threat for that seat, but just a little extension to the amazing Kubica story. Now, Scott, dropping down to the world of Haas, Nikita Mazepin was furious with Mick Schumacher after qualifying, complained about Schumacher passing him on the outlap, which it turned out Schumacher did have permission to do. Then they ended up side by side into turn 13 and impeding Sebastian Vettel. Then Schumacher was angry with Mazepin's defence in the race when Mazepin moved over on him at the end of the first lap on the straight, did some wing damage. It's not a good relationship, is it?
No, it's not. There's clearly a rift there, and I think it's growing. I don't think they're getting it under control at all. I think part of the problem is that I don't want to pin the blame squarely on Mazepin, but in terms of how the relationship manifests itself publicly, I do think he is the prime offender there, because he's the one who gets so vocal afterwards. He just kind of can't help himself. He's pretty outspoken, and I just think his emotions get the better of him sometimes. So he tends to hit out when he probably shouldn't. And then after qualifying, it was weird because his initial anger was kind of understandable based on what he probably knew at the time. But then he had it explained to him and still went on the attack on Schumacher after having it explained to him that it was actually Haas's fault, really, because they'd given Schumacher permission to do something that had been agreed he wouldn't do. So I don't think Schumacher really did anything wrong, but Mazepin still sort of went after him. And then the second part of it is on track, Mazepin doesn't really seem to be learning. He's sort of moving around in places where he shouldn't be, and he's just, in Schumacher's eyes anyway, Mazepin's taking way too many risks against his teammate over nothing positions, basically. So you then have this situation where you can tell Schumacher's gradually getting more riled up. You know, as I say, he isn't the more outspoken of the two, but we've seen it a couple of times now. Baku was the first when Mazepin moved over on him at high speed. And this at Zandvoort was the second, where Mazepin was, I think, moving late in the braking zone, I think, was what upset Mick this time. So that has tipped Mick into saying things quite strongly in public about Mazepin now. So yeah, we're just in a situation where it's I don't think the two get on. I don't think they're ever going to get on. I think as long as they're teammates, there is going to be this underlying tension now. But you obviously spoke to both of them and Günther Steiner as well, didn't you, Ed? So you're probably better placed to comment on how badly this is spiraling out of control.
Yeah, certainly on Saturday, it was very clear there was a problem. Mazepin's strange. He just seems to, obviously he's determined to beat Schumacher, and he's lagged behind much of the season. And he just seems to not be able to let things go. It was very odd that he was continuing to stick the knife in on Mick Schumacher at a point where the team had basically said, yeah, they had caused the problem, because the Saturday problem was Mazepin didn't understand why he'd been passed, because he'd been told you can't pass your teammate on those outlaps. He hadn't been told that Schumacher had been given permission to do it because he needed a faster outlap to warm up the tyres. So the team originated it. So he should be angry with them, really. In the race, I wasn't really very impressed with what Mazepin did. It was a proper move on the straight. He moved late when he saw Schumacher coming. And those moves are unacceptable and incredibly dangerous. He made contact with the front wing, but it wouldn't have taken things to be much different to have launched a car into the pit wall properly. So that needs to be clamped down upon. I think if they weren't teammates, that would have been picked up on by the stewards. And the stewards need to actually, while they've got this policy of if teammates get into each other, they generally let them get away with it. That's a general safety matter. And that's the second time we've seen that this season from Mazepin. And that needs to not happen. And it's a shame because actually Mazepin's sort of started to show some decent promise in terms of pace this weekend. This is the first weekend where you might have said he had a shot of outqualifying Mick Schumacher on pace. And perhaps that's why Mazepin was so angry. But yeah, difficult situation they've got at that team. It's clearly pretty fractious. Mazepin's the more publicly aggressive about it, but Schumacher is diplomatic. But reading between the lines, it's clear what he thinks. Well, Mark, finally, let's just have a quick look ahead to Monza because we're straight on there. Next, low downforce, sprint qualifying, we're back. Any feeling for who might have the edge there? I think you've already given us a clue on that one from what you said earlier about the relative performance of Red Bull and Mercedes.
Yeah, in the dry, I'd be very surprised if it wasn't Mercedes all the way. If it's wet, I haven't seen a forecast actually for this weekend, but it's sometimes wet at Monza, isn't it? If it's wet, it gets a lot closer. In the dry, it's got Mercedes written all over it.
Yeah, that seems reasonable. Connected to that is a question, Scott, from Yanis van der Waal, who asked if perhaps Verstappen should take his potential engine change there with the penalties that come with it, or should he save it for later? You're always on top of Honda business. Does it strike you as a little bit too early for that?
I think it is. I think not so much in terms of timing to get to the rest of the season, because obviously Perez took strategic penalties here because he qualified so poorly. So Honda obviously think that's enough to get to the end of the season. So I think a change at Monza would be enough logistically in terms of managing the rest of the year. But I don't think it's necessarily the best track. I think it's fair to say that Mercedes probably the favourite for Monza. But correct me if I'm wrong, but last year, didn't we see Bottas and actually Verstappen until he had the problem stuck in the DRS train during the race and struggling to make progress? Because I can't remember which way around it was, but I just think that they just weren't particularly competitive last year. Didn't qualify very well, and then I think he was just stuck in the pack. So I don't know whether this is. I don't think Monza is necessarily, because everyone takes their low wings there, low drag wings. I don't think it's quite like Spa in the sense of how you can work your way up to the front. So I actually wonder if whether Red Bull would fancy their chances less at a place like Sochi and just think, well, that's one that Max is probably only going to be third at. So maybe we'll take the penalty there, because then you've got two really long straights with DRS. Just gradually pick your way up the order, whereas Monza it's just a bit easier to trip up over people, maybe get a bit stuck. But I honestly don't know. And if the calendar had gone ahead as normal, I'd have said Sochi for sure, taking the grid penalties there, taking the grid penalties at Sochi, and then had a fresh engine for Suzuka. That they'd have been looking ahead to that one. Obviously, I think it would have been Turkey in between, but they'd have had their eyes on Suzuka, I'm sure, but now the absence of that race, I'm not entirely sure how they're going to play it.
Yeah, it's something they could also take a view on during the weekend, I guess, and see how it looks, although there's not much time given there's only one free practice session as well, so straight into qualifying on Friday. So, interesting one. It is worth remembering that, as you point out, Monza's not such a great overtaking circuit, even though there is the extra bit of racing with the sprint race.
Yeah, actually, your reference to sprint race there is just made me think, Ed, as well. I don't think they'll take the grid penalty at Monza, because they'd have to start at the back for the race itself. And I just think it's a waste of time, basically, to have to go through the process of qualifying and the sprint race just to then start at the back of the grid because of a bunch of engine change penalties, you know? So I wonder if they're... I think they might wait a few races yet.
Yeah, that would probably seem very sensible. And finally, before we sign off, we've got to briefly mention the banking, particularly Turn 3, properly. I know we briefly touched on it, but that really added something, didn't it, Mark? The challenge of the different lines the drivers took. It was It's a great addition. We need to see more of that sort of thing, don't we?
Yeah, completely. It brought a completely new dimension, just that particular part of the track. And it's also because there's one quick line through it, which Fernando Alonso was very quickly on too, but there are a variety of feasible lines, and that's what makes it good for racing, because you don't necessarily have to get, you know, so compromised by the wake of the car ahead of you. And so it makes a lot of feasible lines there, and it just adds to the visual drama of it. I mean, it took a little ride around there in a sort of motorized thing, this trolley thing, this morning, and as you're approaching it, it's, you know, you're looking at a wall, and you can imagine first time through there, you're thinking, how am I going to get through here at any speed? It's just a very different sensation to the conventional corners that we're used to, and definitely brings a new element to it.
Yeah, the more variety, the better. Do you enjoy the banking, Scott? And thumbs up for Zandvoort.
Yeah, I loved it. Like I said, I thought it was a brilliant addition. One of the it's very rare that I actually care about a corner in particular. Normally, it's kind of like sequences of corners or whole tracks in terms of the character that they bring. Like for example, just Imola or the overall sort of roller coaster nature of Algarve, for example, seeing stuff like that. But I think, like, as much as I think Zandvoort as a whole is very cool and lots about it was just really awesome to see cars around there in anger, just that image of the banked turn three in particular is just, that will stick with me from the weekend. So it was an absolute highlight for sure.
Yeah, and we're already looking forward to coming back next year. Well, thanks very much to Scott and Mark for your insight. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. There's loads to read there. Mark's race analysis will be up. My driver rating. Scott's writing about some Alpine shenanigans and a little bit about what Lewis Hamilton thinks of the Red Bull performance. Make sure you check out our sister podcasts, including the Race IndyCar podcast and Bring Back V10s. And if video's your thing, head to our YouTube channel. We're heading south to Monza next, and we'll be back soon with everything you need to know about the Italian Grand Prix. Or if there's driver news in the next few days, which is very possible, we'll be back even sooner.